Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit. And welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode number 113, which sounds like it should be unlucky.
It does sound like it should be unlucky, but it isn't.
Well, let's hope so. We've got an hour or so of someone's time listening to this podcast to prove otherwise. Welcome to the show. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Thrillers.
Crime.
Suspense.
And mysteries. Welcome to the show. And it's lovely that we're going to be joined by Colin Harvey later in the show, who is a fabulous author of things that you would not necessarily associate with being written.
Indeed.
That's a bit cryptic, I know. Well, I'll explain. He has written lots of things, but he works also pretty extensively in the video games industry, where a lot of writing is required. You think of writing a video game as actually being like a screenplay.
Yes, so there are similarities with that, aren't there?
Particularly in the fantasy genre, or indeed anything that involves character scenes.
Yeah.
And so he'll explain more, but it is a very, it's a growing market. It's a well-paid market as well. You might ears prick up across the podcast sphere when they hear that. He's also teaches writing as well in this fashion. And has a great story to tell. It was a fascinating insight into a world that I'd never considered from the point of view of the writing craft.
It certainly widened our horizons, didn't it?
It did.
It's very valuable.
It really was. So, Colin, to speak to it later. Listen, I wanted to just, before we get into the news, I wanted to follow up and just recommend if my rant about the Gary Lineker situation and the BBC and the state of the BBC last week pricked your interest. Actually, there were two articles in the Telegraph, Daily Telegraph in the UK this week, written by former members of the staff in John Humphreys, I should say, former Today presenter and presenter of major national bulletins, and also mastermind and a big old harumph. And of course, the other great grandee of harumphing, Jeremy Paxman, who is presenting currently his last season of University Challenge. Parkinson's. He no longer works full time for the BBC and so has been sort of a freelance presenter. But both of them put the whole situation about how it's really of the BBC's own making by allowing Gary Lineker to think that he's got the freedom to do what he damn well pleases and all of the implications that has on their policy of trying to be impartial, the management behind it, the effect on staff who have to abide by the rules. And the impact on those people who decided either to work last weekend or not. And the abuse they got if they did work on social media. It's brilliant. Both articles really nail, essentially, in a much more intelligent, as you'd expect, and erudite way, but also more considered way, what I was trying to say.
Brilliant.
So check those out. Sorry about that.
That's all I have to say. Yeah.
I thought it was worth a follow-up.
No, what? Absolutely, because you were saying something that we hadn't at that point heard or read about in the media. And so I think it sort of gives you a bit of validation, doesn't it, on what you were saying, that the fact great voices were saying...
I feel a little bit vindicated in the sense that, yeah, a lot of the themes that I was talking about, which got lost in the noise...
Exactly.
...got picked out. And, yeah. and really it is about the... incredibly difficult line that everybody in that organisation has to tread in terms of deciding where impartiality sits. In fact, Paxman says, look, the best BBC managers are the ones that just leave you alone and don't get involved. But in the current climate, you just can't do that because everyone's poking their noses in and accusing the BBC of all sorts of things. But I will say this, it's still unforgivable that you can pay one person a certain amount of money that would have saved the BBC singers from extinction, which is what they've been told this week, that they're wrapped up in a couple of weeks' time or whatever it is, that the proms, they'll start the proms without the BBC singers.
That is just, it's tragic.
Yeah, and cuts to the orchestras across the piece.
Yeah, tragic. I would like to say I haven't yet had my phone call from the BBC with the offer of...
Well, miraculously, after we did the podcast on the Monday, just to wrap up that story, basically the BBC sort of climbed down in a major way and said, we're going to launch a review to decide how to handle these things in the future. And in the meantime, Mr. Lineker is coming back, at which point he didn't apologise at all. In fact, it was left to Alan Shearer to apologise for the impact on other people and to the audience when they did Match of the Day this week. So, I'm not sure you're going to get the call because everyone's back at work now.
I'm still waiting. It might come.
You never know.
Maybe a comic relief edition.
That would be appropriate, yeah. And you would love to raise money for the charities.
I would. The charities.
Charities. Look, news is really thin on the ground in the publishing world at the moment, you know, of enough significance for us to really want to comment on it. One or two little tidbits, but what should we talk about first? We were going to talk about our week as well.
Yes.
And what we've just been, we've been to Exeter, but we'll talk about that. What stories have grabbed your attention?
Well, I mean, the Nibbies, the shortlist of the Nibbies is dominated. But
that's the National Book Awards for those who've mentioned this before.
There's lots of prizes. Also the Independent Publishing Guild award as well. I've seen a lot about that, but we're not going to talk about that today because the next big crime event coming up is Crime Fest.
Mm.
And they've just revealed, I think it's the shortlists for the debut award, which they do, sponsored by Specsavers, isn't it? And a friend of the podcast and a friend of the two of us is on that list. That's Graham Bartlett.
Yeah. Graham, well done.
With his book, Bad for Good.
Yeah, Bad for Good, which was his debut, as you say. And his second one's, I think, ready to come out now.
Yes, it's imminent, isn't it?
And he's going to be at Crime Fest sharing a panel with our very own Brian Price, talking about the social elements of crime writing and impact on society. So that I'm sort of paraphrasing, so I apologise if that's completely the wrong sort of emphasis, but that that's what I picked up and gleaned. So congratulations to him. Who are the other nominees?
So for that particular prize, which is a debut crime novel, we have a book called A Good Day to Die by Armin Alonji?
Probably Alonji, yeah.
We have The Maid by Nita Prose.
Mm-hmm.
Ashes in the Snow by Oriana Ramuno. It's HarperCollins, that one. We have a book called Kelman by Joachim B. Schmidt.
Yeah.
Dirt Town by Hayley Scrivener.
Yeah.
The Siege by John Sutherland.
Mm-hmm.
And A Flicker in the Dark by Stacey Willingham. So I don't actually know those other books. I mean, they're debut crime novels.
No, I'm not familiar with them.
No, so Graham, obviously, because we know Graham and a lot of the people who've...
Well, it's always exciting to see people, you know, getting an opportunity like this. And I do hope that Crime Fest is being supported by some amazing names again. It's like a mini Harrogate yet again. some of the best names. People that we met last year. Andrew Child is back.
Yes, and I noticed, I think Lisa Jewell is going to be there.
Yeah, and Janice Hallett is there too.
Yeah, so we can try and get Janice
we'll
on
finally
the podcast
get her
again.
On the podcast, which we've been meaning to do for ages, but we're planning to go. And I do believe, you know, again, I'm paraphrasing here, but I think that the end of the month is the point where the slightly cheaper tickets are available. And then after that, it's full price. And that's quite a big leap, actually, for those who wish to go to Bristol and Crime Fest. It's a really terrific event in terms of being, I think, in a sense, it is an easier thing to negotiate if you've not been to an event like this before than Harrogate.
Oh, absolutely. The atmosphere, I don't know.
It's more collegiate.
It's hard to put into words, isn't it? But it is a sort of a more relaxed atmosphere. I could quite happily sit on my own at Crime Fest, whereas Harrogate, I would have felt a bit strange sat on my own.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point.
Yeah, so I could sit with a book and a cup of coffee or a gin and tonic or whatever. and yeah, I'd be quite happy.
Absolutely. Anything else that's caught your eye? Or should we move on to what we did this week?
News-wise, I don't think there was anything else, was there, really?
Well, there is one thing, actually, yeah. And this is... I don't want to get into the habit and being regarded as someone who bashes Findaway Voices. Now, just to explain who Findaway Voices were and are. So, Findaway Voices, we've been using them for over 2 years now to publish all of our audiobooks. And when it started, the main advantage was that it was one place you could put your audiobook and it would arrive in a growing and changing list of audiobook platforms. And it averages around the 40 to 50 mark, 48 to 50 mark, I should say. And includes US library lending, which is actually quite a valuable area. But it also goes to Audible and to all the obvious places. So that was one advantage. Another thing is that it kind of just broke out the sort of dominance of Audible, which in many ways is still problematic. I mean, the biggest problem is that you can't really market through Audible yet. But that was all very good. And the other thing is that you could be put forward for Chirp deals, which is the BookBub equivalent for audiobooks, which puts your audiobook at, of course, at discount rate, but in front of thousands of potential listeners, which, again, is a big advantage. Now, we submit our audiobooks regularly for those deals, and we've only had one out of the dozens I've applied for. So it does work if they let you through. Now, that was all very well, but middle of last summer in the UK, Spotify emerged and bought the company for about $250 million, I think it was. And nothing really happened for a bit. That was the announcement. And that was it. And then, as you will remember, my ranting of 3, 4, maybe 5 weeks ago, when we've discovered that they had put a clause in, which had been there for some time, to be fair, which was at right at the back end of every contract, which allowed them to send then the narrators that appear through Findaway, their voices, to Apple. So that Apple's AI narration system could learn from those voices and potentially copy them without any recompense for the narrator or for the people who've paid for the production, people like ourselves, or indeed independent authors. And that really angered us, and me particularly. We have withdrawn our support of that and asked them to drop that. Then this week they announced that one of the things we have is a shopfront on our website where you can buy the audiobooks at a discount rate, less than you would get it at Audible or indeed from any other platform. They're pulling that up as well. They're now saying that I think it was beginning of June, you will no longer be able to sell your books on a platform.
Yeah.
It has to go through Spotify. So yet again, another thing that made it attractive for us has gone, and it was just... That's it. We're pulling up the drawbridge. We're no longer doing this. You have to, you know, that's it. If you've got listeners who've been listening to and buying books from you direct from your website, they'll now have to access them with a special code through Spotify. It's kind of what we expected. And now there's a price war between Audible and Spotify for the book. So they're now all cutting prices, but no creator has the chance to actually tell either platform how they should be priced. They're just trying to rush to the bottom. So again, I'm afraid it's got to the point where we're going to have to look very seriously at pulling all the books and all the productions out of Findaway's grip. And any future ones, I don't know where we put them, is the truth.
No.
So that made me angry again this week. I mean, honestly, customer relations, now that Findaway, who market themselves as the approachable and, accessible company that was trying to beat the man, is now owned by the Spotify man, so to speak.
Different man, then.
Yeah, and is behaving just as objectionably as Audible can do and Amazon do.
And we're just a small fry.
That's how it feels. It's not good. It's not good. Anyway, our week. We tried to put a more positive spin on the publishing scene. we were invited by Exeter University, which, of course, Any listeners to our program will know that's where Rebecca and I both studied and we met and we snogged.
As he told everybody.
Yeah. As I told the poor, appalled students, the young people of our background. But we were invited to join a sort of evening of insights into publishing, both as a writer and as publishers, and also we did a CV clinic.
We did, yeah. So we had to
look at people's CVs and gave them advice. It was a really, really good event, actually. Very flattered to be asked, and I don't know about you, but I got so much positive energy from it, from seeing people who are like we were 30-odd years ago, you know, desperate to know more.
Yes, exactly that. So they were sort of sponges for information and knowledge from us. And that's the first time in a long time I've been in that experience of people looking up to you as wisdom. So yeah. It took me a little while to get into that frame of mind.
It did, yeah, you did feel an element of imposter syndrome. And look, and you know, before we pretend that we went there and said we're the big IAMs, we did not. We said, look, it's a really tough industry, A, to get into, B, to sustain, and you know, as yet our proof of concept is that, you know, we're still going, but we haven't, you know, really had the level of sort of success we anticipated 3 years ago when we set up. I think, so, you know, as we are on this podcast, we're honest about the challenges, but we wanted to be encouraging and give them enthusiasm and to make them anybody attending, whoever we encountered, go away feeling that it's not a closed world. Yes, it's competitive. Yes, tens of thousands of people want to join the industry every year, but they can do things in the time they've got while at university to put themselves in the very best position to get started.
Absolutely. And I was actually very impressed especially with the CVs I looked at, some of the things they've already done, which I thought, you know, I didn't have quite so many opportunities when I was at university. They're in a good position. They're in a very strong position already.
They are, yeah. And then on the Friday, taking full advantage of the fact we were there, I offered to do it was very ad hoc, masterclass for the student radio station, which I used to run back in the 90s, and the current committee still presiding over what is now an unbelievably well-equipped, beautifully pointed set of studios compared to what we had, which was a concrete shoebox with no natural light in it whatsoever unless the front door was open. And the collective smells of students for 25 years. It was a grotty old hole.
It was a proper shoe cupboard, wasn't it?
It was a shoe cupboard, and well, actually a crockery cupboard that was converted into a studio. But it was our home. It was our pride and joy. But to see it now, you know, with facilities that would shame many, many other radio stations, was fantastic. And they were so kind to bring out tons and tons of memorabilia and documents and sort of records, not for the physical vinyl ones, but the sort of the paper trail from my generation.
Yeah, so things like minutes from meetings with you getting angry at people in the minutes. But I don't know, did you notice that?
Yeah. Did you read the one which said, yeah, meeting open with Adrian grousing about such and such, brackets, big surprise.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
It was someone had to do it.
But did you see your photo is still there?
Yeah.
There's a windowsill and it had three photos from various ages of
me and my then big hair.
And they hadn't realised that was you. So I said, that's him. He's just got a lot more hair there.
Yeah, and I've got, and no glasses. I didn't wear glasses in those days. Yes, and I was a bit thinner. So, yeah, I mean, it was really gratifying. And I think the sort of 2 days together, yes, it was a break from the norm, but it reminds you of how far we've come, both as publishers, as a company, but as people in that time period. And it's paying a little bit back. And I can't wait to do it again, to be perfectly honest.
No, I said that two or three times to the alumni person who sort of
I would like to give credit to Liz Johnson for organizing it and her team. She's just joined the alumni team. It's a big team, and they're doing a fantastic job. So, you know, students at Exeter are very lucky. It's a great university and it's such a wonderful location, but it's just, they have really raised their game in terms of supporting the students and making it, you know, basically, I mean, even to the extent that they've got an empathy dog that comes once a week to go so that the students don't feel isolated and they can pet the dog.
Which is, I think, is a brilliant idea because
Ted was lovely.
When I started university, that was one of the things I missed the most was pets because you just don't have pets when you leave home.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. So credit to them. Thank you for your hospitality. We hope our time and effort paid off for you. And we look forward to hearing from the students who took our business cards and see if we can help.
Well, I've had a lot more matches on LinkedIn. Is it matches?
Yeah. LinkedIn.
That sounds like Tinder,
crazy,
doesn't it? But yeah, LinkedIn. Yeah. I've had lots of invites to connect. So that was good.
Okay. Yeah. No. So, really energy. I come back with a lot of energy. Well, I actually haven't channeled the energy, but I feel uplifted. So that's.
Well, you see, I feel a bit strange because I felt very uplifted on the day we came back. But 2 days later, I now feel quite flat.
Yeah, we've got it. Both of us, you've got monumental challenges with tons of stuff, and I have too. Both of us with our freelance side of things, big deadlines looming, and need to get our heads down. And on a sideline, my health is not good at the minute because they put me on a new drug and it doesn't work. It makes me feel absolutely horrific. So it's, I feel like I've gone back to square one in many ways, in terms of my resilience, but the extra trip was worth it. Let's get to the interview then. So our guest this week on the Hobcast Book Show is Colin Harvey. And it really hadn't occurred to me just how much writing goes into some of the big blockbuster titles that get released for stations like the PlayStation or platforms like the PlayStation. Mm. Xbox, and for the PC. I mean, these are productions that cost more than most of the big movies that get released nowadays. We're talking about investments for certain games of nearly $500 million.
It's incredible.
Well, they will generate $4 billion in revenue because they're guaranteed hits. And so part of that process is that it's a bit like making a movie, but with all the interactivity and options within the game, if you're living in a game world, this is what Colin does. He writes game worlds, he creates characters, he provides the screenplay from which the rest of the game will, the narrative of a game that will expand. Now, of course, that isn't necessarily going to be the case in, if you're racing or something like that on Formula One or playing basketball, but there are still story elements within there.
Yeah.
We're talking about
has to create that
world, created worlds which you interact with and play with, and particularly now in virtual reality. And this is a niche that he has developed. But as he tells us, his love of writing and particularly thinking about how to tell stories in games started at a very early age.
Oh, it's a great story, but you'll hear about that in the interview.
So let's speak to Colin Harvey. Colin Harvey, welcome to the Hobcast Book Show.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to speak to you. And we've been really sort of broadening our church the last few weeks, haven't we, Rebecca, in terms of the people we've been speaking to. We've talked to poets and all sorts.
Oh, yes. Well, we'll speak to anyone really anyway. But
yeah, but no, it's all in
anyone who loves words.
Exactly. In service of the word. And indeed, you're coming at this game from a different angle to one we've spoken to anybody about before, because you work across many genres, many formats, I suppose, is a better way of putting it. And I don't think we've ever spoken to anybody who is involved in the games industry, which is fabulous. So take us first of all into that and where writing and storytelling comes into it, because to many listeners they'll be thinking, where's the story in XYZ, video game on a PlayStation? But that's not the case. I mean, there's a lot of work goes into that element, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think for people who don't necessarily play games, you might kind of have an image of what games are like, which might be something like, I don't know, Tetris or sort of...
That's me. Are you describing me?
Yeah. And of course, those games, there are lots of games like that that have no real kind of interest in kind of storytelling. And they're very popular and they're very, beautifully kind of elegantly kind of designed. But there are lots and lots of games which have some kind of storytelling kind of going on. And increasingly, you know, they have budgets that are kind of like really quite comparable to kind of, you know, Hollywood kind of budgets. And they attract the same sort of talent that Hollywood attracts. So, you know, lots of quite famous kind of actors kind of crop up in kind of contemporary games. And you know, if you play sort of modern games of a certain kind, like PlayStation games or kind of Xbox games or PC games, lots of elements of it will look like a movie. You know, you feel like you are kind of playing a kind of movie. And that's, you know, that's a big part of what a kind of game writer does, or a narrative designer, which is kind of related kind of discipline. So my day job is to kind of write, you know, I write the screenplay for, you know, it's a screenplay that looks like the kind of screenplay you would find in a movie, for those bits of the game that are kind of the more linear kind of bits of the game that are kind of non-interactive. But there's also, of course, all the interactive stuff that you get in games as well. So that's where perhaps the more kind of narrative design kind of element comes into it, where, you know, you can kind of explore an environment and kind of find, you know, meet characters within that environment and talk to them and kind of find what we call collectibles, you know, kind of find artifacts. If it's a sword and sorcery game, you might find a treasure, and, you know, you might find documents that you kind of read. So that's all part of it as well, sort of like kind of creating this kind of this interactive world that you then explore. So it's you know, I think there are lots of different kind of kinds of writing involved in kind of video game writing. So as I say, there's kind of screenwriting, but there's also a lot of it is actually kind of audio. So it's kind of like radio, you know, because I have a background in kind of radio stuff. So that's always quite a useful kind of skill. And audio can often kind of save you if something's gone wrong elsewhere in the kind of construction of the game. You can kind of use it to kind of fill plot holes, which I have done in the past. So, it's kind of multifaceted kind of thing, really.
I was just thinking it's like a book, but with different dimensions. So the similar skills to writing a book or a series, but you've got all these other dimensions of the visuals and the like you say, the characters and the audio for the plot holes. I like that.
Yeah, I think it's very similar skills around kind of world building, I think. You know, and again, like movies, you'd have, or a TV series, we have a kind of story bible that you kind of create, which, of course, because you've got all these different disciplines as well, like the art team, the animation team, production, and obviously the programmers, who then sometimes they need to kind of refer to, you know, all this stuff to kind of make sure what they're doing isn't contradicting what you're kind of doing on your side. I mean, I guess a key kind of difference with, say, cinema or television is that lots of things that require a kind of script is that you tend to get what we call kind of parallel kind of development kind of happening. So whereas with a movie or a TV show, you write the script and then everything else kind of flows from the script.
Yeah.
Whereas in a game studio, you're often kind of working on the story at the same time that, say, the art team are kind of working on concepting kind of art, or the programmers are kind of exploring new kind of new kind of technical things, or the gameplay team are kind of working out, oh yeah, we'd like to do this and this, you know. And it is so it's kind of different in that regard. And often because the script and the story is seen as being the softer sort of thing, the more malleable kind of thing,
yes,
you're liable to be the thing that has to change in order to accommodate, you know, the fact that these guys over here want to do this, and, you know, so so there are lots of similarities, but then lots of differences to these other kind of like storytelling kind of media. And if, like me, you kind of work in these different media, it's really interesting then to kind of compare and contrast. Oh yeah, I can do that because this is I'm working on a short story, or I can do this because it's a comic and it's not interactive. But I can't do that with this game because it's interactive, and somebody's gonna, you know, they need to, this plot needs to go in three different directions at this point, or what have you, you know.
Of course, yes, you have to leave forks in the road where, you know, you give autonomy to the player to decide which direction you go in. And I presume that sometimes there'll be things that you've written that 90% of the population never see because they always go the other way.
But
yeah.
There's those books I remember from my childhood which were written like that, weren't they? If you want to do this, go to page this.
And yes. Yeah.
Whatever happened to them?
I think they've been superseded by games.
Yeah. Choose your own adventure books. Yeah, absolutely. They're a big big kind of influence. They kind of emerged in the kind of 80s, and they have a kind of strong relationship with what we kind of do in terms of games, particularly just that kind of branching kind of narrative which we're describing, where the game can go that way or that way. There's loads of challenges around writing that kind of stuff, because if you have a narrative which starts to kind of branch and then it branches again and again and again, you know, quickly it kind of proliferates all these
like
different
cauliflower.
Kind of like, yeah, completely. So you have to kind of find kind of clever ways of kind of bringing it back around. And then, that's just in the context of a book, but in the context of a game, as you suggest, it might be the case that you wouldn't necessarily see a particular kind of branch unless you played the game through again. So so there's always, again, and that's a kind of expensive activity, is to kind of build lots of stuff that people don't necessarily kind of see. So there's always that kind of tension within kind of games, that kind of game, which is a very specific kind of branching kind of game. And then there are other games where you're more in a kind of exploratory kind of area, and
yes,
you're finding things within that kind of environment, which are less. So they it depends how you define branching, but they're kind of, you know, so it might be that you go over here and you find something, so it's branching in that regard. But you know, you're not building what we call big kind of cutscenes. The cutscenes are the kind of the movie kind of elements of the game, effectively, which are the expensive bits.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't played games consistently for a very long time, and many, you know, when I have, and this is like 3 years or so.
The hospital game.
No, but what I'm saying is that I gravitated towards the games that were a little bit more sort of scenario based, and, you know, here's your level, this is what you've got to try and solve, off you go and do it. Something, you know, simpler. I had the first three iterations of PlayStation, and those cutscenes where the actors came in and, you know, they pretended to be mafia bosses and all that sort of stuff was all clearly all written, and it had to be then acted and then digitized and all that sort of thing. Nowadays, of course, you've got these open world games where you can just go and interact with everything in it. And I'm thinking of the last time I played anything like that was Grand Theft Auto 5, that kind of era, or anything by Rockstar, which, again, needs writing. But also you've got to have an algorithm there that can create free speech depending on each scenario. It's quite extraordinary.
I was going to say, it must be really complicated.
Yeah, it is. It is. Really is.
Yes, it can get very kind of complicated. So that's, you know, as I say, the kind of screenplay kind of bits of it are kind of, you know, they're in a way they're the much more kind of static things. And once you've gone and done motion capture, you know, when you kind of put the kind of sensors around the actors and you've kind of caught all that kind of stuff, it's very expensive to kind of change that generally. So that stuff tends to be fairly set once you've kind of got it, and you have more flexibility kind of changing that stuff in the kind of the game world itself, the kind of the environment that you're able to kind of explore, as I say, with kind of things like kind of audio and stuff. And I think, I mean, the comparison I always use for people who don't really play games a lot is from an author's, well, for the writer's point of view, it's a bit like a musical, I think, would be a good kind of analogy. So if you remember the musical has, you know, you have a bit of story and then everyone breaks into song and then you go back into the narrative and so on and so on. And so games are a bit like that, because you have, you'll have like a bit of narrative, then you have gameplay, then you have another bit of narrative, another bit of gameplay. And the trick, a bit like I think the better kind of musicals, is that you're trying to advance the plot at the same time within those interactive kind of sections, just as you would be within a song.
When you're writing for these in this way, and they're doing the motion capture stuff, are you involved? Are you on set there, ready to make any alterations? Because often with TV drama, or if you've got a particularly big star in a Hollywood movie who then demands a rewrite because he doesn't want to say a certain line, and you have to go in and is that what happens to you guys, or is it pretty much set in stone once you've laid down those words?
Yes, certainly the last big game that I kind of worked on, I was there in the motion capture studio. And, you know, in fact, we did lots of rehearsals and we kind of modified the script as we kind of went to kind of, because we wanted to be quite a kind of naturalistic kind of performance. And in fact, so for instance, we had a whole sequence set in a kind of modern art gallery. And the idea, it's a virtual reality game. So the idea was you could go around and you could kind of play around with the kind of the exhibits basically, and destroy the, I don't know what it was, the commentary on kind of modern art was, but you could destroy the kind of the different kind of the exhibits.
No,
you know, that thing of kind of pulling out things and watching the whole thing kind of collapse around you, and especially in VR, which is quite kind of amazing. But because we wanted the kind of the actors to be kind of quite kind of spontaneous, then there was a lot of kind of freedom in terms of the script, in terms of what we were doing. But of course, the script needed to be completely kind of accurate. So my role in that case was kind of like we're kind of iterating with the actors, and then we're kind of modifying the script so that we have a kind of a genuine kind of authentic kind of script when we get back to the studio. So we know exactly what we have. You know, it does actually kind of match up and stuff. So yeah, it can depend on. It depends on the kind of project again a lot, but. Certainly the last two projects I've been there in terms of, you know, the motion capture stuff, which in a way is the most, that's the real kind of magical kind of stuff, because you're watching the actors, as I said, with all these kind of sensors all over them, but then you're watching a kind of puppet version of them on the screen, and a kind of basic version of the kind of set, which also has kind of sensors around it. And then when you get back to the studio, or perhaps kind of in parallel, the art team are kind of building what the set will kind of look like, and then the whole thing is kind of comes together. So yeah. that stuff is, I find, completely kind of fascinating, really, because it's, and what's really fascinating as well, especially because of the VR stuff we were doing, was that the actors, because often games are kind of drawing on film, they're very heavily influenced by cinema, but actually in that case the actors would say this is much more like doing theater, because you'd have, in terms of doing a sequence, they'd have a whole sequence they would record, we would capture. And it wasn't possible to kind of edit that sequence once you captured it. So it's like, it's not like a movie in that regard. It's much more like there's this big block of data. So that means the actors have to kind of know their lines and go through the lines in one, you know, they have to do it all the way through. So in that regard, it's like being live in a stage play, because there's no cutting to kind of, because it's VR, so it's a consistent kind of perspective. So there's no ability to kind of cut to kind of close-ups and et cetera.
Yeah, none of that artifice in the edit. You can't, fix it in the edit. You can't do that. You can't go to a cutaway or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, in other traditional cutscenes, you can, but in that kind of context, you couldn't.
It's painstakingly long process producing a game of this caliber and size. So is that one of the... I mean, I don't know if that's a frustration to you, because, you know, you might work on something and it might take X amount of time for it to then come to fruition. I mean, you know, and see your work in because I, you know, I get the impression, you know, these games can take, 3 years to develop. So I don't know if that's, you know, my layman's misapprehension, but that must be, is that a frustration to you?
Well, it's kind of, it's that thing of kind of watching it kind of come together. So you kind of, as I say, you kind of like, you record the kind of like, if you like, the spine of the thing, which is, you know, the screenplay kind of element of it. And then it's a process of kind of like iterating within, this is where the narrative design side comes in. So when you're in the kind of the gameplay kind of elements, you kind of, you're in there kind of experimenting and see what kind of works. So the same game that I mentioned with the art exhibit, I was inside what we call the game engine and kind of like positioning the dialogue and trying to work out which bit of dialogue goes where, you know, and making sure this will have the kind of maximum, I need the player to kind of know this plot point here. So I've got to position this kind of piece of dialogue there. So at that point, that's where it kind of, I would say, stops. You stop being a writer and you become the narrative designer kind of side of things, really. It's a sort of, 2 or 3 year, all the games I've worked on. But then you get these much bigger games that can take, you know, so you mentioned Rockstar, I think Red Dead Redemption, which was their big kind of Western game that came out a few years ago. I think that took something like 6 years, I think. Yes. And then other games, you know, even longer, like the next Grand Theft Auto has been in development a long time. And you know, so these are becoming really quite long, even compared to movies. They're becoming, you know, a really kind of long development process
and more expensive. I mean, the, you know, we're talking about £300 million budgets and all that sort of thing, aren't we, for those sort of scale of games?
Yeah, I mean, I've not worked on anything quite that scale, but I have worked on things with budgets that I can't reveal. But you know, you think, oh my God, I'll probably never get to work on anything this big again. You know, and it is. Comparable to kind of to a kind of small scale kind of feature film kind of budget, you know.
Mm. What sort of personal skills are, well, I was interpersonal skills, I should use the word, does it take to work in a production of this scale with so many moving parts? I mean, admittedly, you know, like any technical project, the fewer moving the parts, the better in terms of from the developer's point of view. But nonetheless, there's an awful lot of people collaborating here.
Have to be a good people person.
Yeah, that's quite. is that difficult to sort of find your niche and your voice in that sort of environment?
I think, I mean, the obvious thing, I guess, I mean, this is probably true of like most things, right? You can't be a prima donna with your, with anything, you know, you kind of, and you've really got to know when to kind of fight, which battles to kind of fight. And when, and also because things are often kind of, you're up against kind of particular kind of deadlines, and you're kind of trying to kind of line different kind of things up. Different disciplines are kind of trying to kind of line things up. So, you've got to choose which kind of battle you're going to fight. Really, my previous boss sort of described me as unflappable, which really surprised me, because actually I may give that impression, but actually I was absolutely like
inside.
Yeah, it's like
yeah,
it's all going wrong.
Sounds like me, know? Actually.
But so it's a slight it is that ability to kind of be interested in what these other disciplines are kind of saying, and also I guess an awareness that it's fundamentally a game. It's not, you know, in the end it's going to be driven by the gameplay. The needs of the gameplay will even if it's a very narrative driven game, you know, that will kind of take kind of priority, I would say, because it's, you know, you're not making a movie, you're not making a, you know, you're not writing a novel. It's, and it's, yeah, clearly very extremely collaborative kind of enterprise, really.
Go on.
Well, I have a question, a bit of a personal question, because I've got three boys, right? And if they were in here now, they would say, that's my dream job. So I want to know, how did you get into this? Because, you know, they might.
Yeah, I wish my kids would. I've got two teenagers. And like, I wish they'd be a bit more kind of, you know.
Yeah, appreciative. That's cool.
Yeah, I will never be cool. Unless they secretly think I'm cool, but don't tell me.
That's possible, because it would be uncool to look like they think you're cool.
I kind of came at it kind of multiple kind of ways, really. So if we go right back, right? So when I was aged 11, I won a computer in a national competition to design a house of the future. So this was 1983. Yeah. And it was to design a house of the future in the far-flung year of the year 2000. And the school entered it. So each class was kind of, you know, so each week you'd do a different kind of room in the house, like, you know, the lounge. And I had a kind of robotic butler and a cat called Moggy and stuff. And so we ended up with a computer, and we had no idea in my household what this thing was. This kind of like, it was like a kind of, it was an Atari 800, and it was kind of like it was a beast. It was kind of like a typewriter and a radiator kind of crossbred and produced this kind of gigantic thing. Yes. And we had so it was plugged into the DER. We had a rental TV. It was plugged into the DER rental TV in the corner of the room. And my dad would sort of sit in the corner of the room kind of smoking, because it was that era. He'd be smoking, kind of chain smoking away. So this kind of fog of smoke kind of. And because the disk drive they gave me didn't work. So I'd type things in from like the manual or from computer game magazines, and like produce, say, the Stars and Stripes or what alleged to be a kind of jazz score. Because I couldn't save it, so it was kind of a very performative kind of thing, because I could gather around the family and say, look, I've done this, and we could all gather around and look. But you know, increasingly I discovered that, you know, I'm not a programmer by any means, but I was interested in those choose your own adventure books and in creative writing and stuff. And I thought, oh yeah, what does kind of interactivity kind of do, you know, and started playing around with Atari Basic and creating these, you know, what we call text adventures, which is really game version of those choose your own adventure books. So, and things like people might remember The Hobbit. There was a version of The Hobbit, which was very popular, which actually had some pictures and, you know, illustrations and stuff, but was primarily driven by the text. And there was a company called Infocom, actually, which was very big, that created lots of these, which were really kind of like interactive books, I guess, you know, sort of interactive fiction from that era. And anyway, that really sort of struck a chord with me back then. And I realized that you could give, say, a player the choice to say, if you said to them, do you want to pick up a sword? And they say yes or no. If they say yes, then you just say sword equals zero in the kind of program. Sword equals one in the program. And then when they meet the dragon later on, if they've got the sword, they can use the sword to kill the dragon. But if they don't, it's decided not to pick up the sword, and sword equals zero, then they don't have the dragon. You know, it goes the kind of wrong way, really. So it was a very kind of simple thing. But I thought, oh, well, that's really interesting, because that's like what you do in creative writing, you know, when you set up an idea and then you pay it off kind of later on. So even quite early on, that was quite kind of fascinating to me, that you could do that. And anyway, so I kind of carried on kind of writing, and my career was really powered by that. That was the first competition that I kind of that I won. My whole career is kind of powered by these competitions. So after I graduated from university, so I did a kind of media production kind of degree. I won I was the BBC Young Radio Critic of the Year 1993. Which sounds impressive, but they only ever ran it once. So I'm the only.
Oh, you're the only
BBC inaugural.
Yeah. But through that, I was able to kind of get work with The Guardian and stuff. And then later on, I entered a short fiction, original fiction competition for SFX magazine.
Oh yeah.
And I won that, and then that kind of propelled another bit of my kind of career and led to me kind of doing licensed kind of tie-in kind of work. So. So I had these different kind of strands, really, kind of going, and then, but I ended up kind of teaching. I was doing kind of university kind of teaching, and I ended up doing a kind of PhD. And again, I kind of came back to that idea of, and this is a big thing within the medium. This is kind of what I've been kind of talking about already, really, which is about that interrelationship between storytelling and kind of play within video games. So I did a PhD in that kind of area. And then meanwhile, I was, you know, still pursuing the kind of creative writing stuff. And eventually I was able to, I got a job actually at Sony doing, this is about 20 years ago, doing kind of pitching kind of ideas, story concepts, really. And then it kind of went from there, really. So I had these different kind of strands, and they all kind of came together. And meanwhile, I was doing journalism as well. So this is kind of what I would recommend to people who want to get, you know, into this kind of field, really, is to kind of come at it these kind of multiple kind of ways.
Eventually, like a game. It's like a game.
Well,
like
yeah,
a game. But you win a competition and you go that way.
A portfolio of income streams and skills, but they all interrelate.
Yeah,
don't they?
Yeah.
I think so. And it was just really driven by that, really, and trying to kind of just a fascination for kind of thinking about this stuff in lots of different ways. So I'm really interested in obviously the creativity of it, but also how you analyze these things, and particularly in this kind of new medium, which I find a really kind of exciting kind of medium. And I would encourage people listening to this, you know, that if they haven't looked at games, and do have a look at games, and because it might not be what you kind of think it is. You might be surprised at what contemporary games, like things like The Last of Us or Ghost of Tsushima or God of War, you know, there's a whole, yeah, we're a real golden age of these narrative driven kind of games. But also there's bigger kind of what we call GaaS games, which are games as a service. There's things like Fortnite and Destiny and Apex Legends. You know, there's loads of these things and loads of opportunities. And I think crucially as well, it's the kind of one of the few kind of forms of writing that you can come across that's actually not too badly paid. It's kind of, you know, most writing, as we know, is not terrifically well paid, and you're doing it more for the love of doing it. But then with this, you know, if you know what you're doing and you're kind of good at it, then you can, you know, you can make a living from it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. What's your, because I know we're going to talk about a project that you're working on with Unbound, which is, for people who don't know, this is a way of, essentially it's crowdsourcing, you know, a book project. But I got the impression from the title, at least, you know, you're taking a position on where things have got to in terms of this side of the artistic development. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's that, I think, you know, the skills involved in game storytelling seem to me to be filtering across to kind of other media.
Yeah.
If you look at, say, like the Mission Impossible movies, and you look at how they're constructed, it seems to me there's a lot of similarities between how they write those movies and how we would create a kind of video game. So that's, to me, is really kind of interesting. And then there's obviously all the stuff around kind of de-aging of actors. So you think about Harrison Ford and the new 80-year-old guy, you know, in the new Indiana Jones movie. You know, there's loads of aspects in which this stuff is changing and kind of feeding each other. And, you know, and social media as well. I mean, the book is partly informed by that as well, in terms of, like, there's lots of storytelling that's going on all the time in terms of Twitter and Facebook and you know, TikTok and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, though, that can be I would say, kind of dangerous thing as well as a kind of like a positive thing. So actually, the need to kind of understand what's happening with this stuff becomes more and more crucial, I think. It's really critical to kind of understand what's happening in the worlds of gaming, what's happening in social media, what's happening with you know, deep fake stuff, you know, all this kind of stuff, because it's not going to go away. It's only going to kind of intensify. So it's really important that everybody kind of, we all kind of understand when we're watching a story that's made up and when we're watching a story that's true, and what's, you know, all those sorts of things, really. These things feel really quite live kind of discussions, really.
Because there's so much blending now, isn't there?
There is. I mean, I was going to ask where you see the position on AI, for instance, which has suddenly, reached that next level of consciousness collectively, where it is now really influencing the creative arts. And some companies, and this is something that affects me as a narrator, we've talked about this at length on the program, but, you know, they are replacing human voices by synthesizing.
Yeah, we're not real. We're AI.
So, I mean, you know, the performance is getting synthesized. I guess where it's leading is that where the human element really is going to remain is the origination of ideas that resonate with other humans. But do you sense that AI is catching up in that way?
Yeah, it still feels important to me. The creator still feels, the human creator feels utterly vital to this, you know, no matter, I mean, this is the thing, isn't it, that kind of, it would seem that AI can convincingly mimic what human creators can produce, but I don't know, and this might maybe seem incredibly kind of old-fashioned and actually sort of like much more of a kind of romantic kind of frame of mind. And hopefully it's not naive, but I would hope that actually the authenticity that kind of, like, because there's a big discussion around authenticity, right? Quite rightly, I would say. And actually the authenticity of the human experience cannot be emulated by a machine. And I don't think ever would be. So that's what I would kind of hope. But as you're kind of alluding to, there's very kind of immediate kind of issues around this stuff, really, in terms of you know, potentially in games or in fact in other media as well. You can get to the point where you could bring an actor in, get the actor to record a kind of a data set of lines, and then generate new dialogue, very convincing sounding new dialogue off the back of that small set of lines that they've already recorded. So
yeah,
and then, you know, but previously you would get the actor back in and you get them to do more lines. Whereas then, you know, so it would involve lots of different, you know, it has implications to kind of copyright and kind of like people's kind of like their ownership over their voice, as well as their likeness, and all these things will need to be kind of reconsidered. So I think, you know, I guess that's where this kind of heads really is into the kind of realms of kind of legislation, really, to try and make sure that you know, that people's creativity is being kind of protected, I think. And that's not just the thing around writing, that's the thing around all of these kind of creative kind of activities which are kind of impacted by this, you know.
Indeed. And you know, to give you an example, just recently, most recent appearance of Darth Vader was AI generated using James Earl Jones's recordings from the 70s onwards, and putting it into a computer and giving him some dialogue lines. And because he's now in his 90s, he's not in a position to sound the same as he did. And so that's what they did. And they de-aged Mark Hamill's voice in a similar fashion for the recent episodes of The Mandalorian. So this is happening. This is happening big time. But you know, just to finish, I mean, that is costing Disney a lot of money to do. And obviously they needed it for a certain project, but it will soon be just common currency, I think.
I was just going to say, I can't imagine Darth Vader being a 90-year-old little old man.
Yeah, he's still, you know, he's a man of presence.
It's always Dave Prowse in my head, you know.
Well, there you go. He was the physical version, and the vocal version was James Earl Jones, as you rightly say. And in fact, he was only in the studio for 2 hours for the original Star Wars.
Oh, really?
Yeah, believe it or not. Well, there you go. So looking forward in terms of storytelling, where do you think it's going? Where does a writer position themselves?
Well, it is that thing around, we have this kind of dread word in kind of like media studies where we talk about kind of convergence, and it does feel like that, really, kind of like there'll be more and more. I mean, I've written around kind of transmedia storytelling, which is kind of like telling kind of connected stories in a kind of in a unified kind of story world. Star Wars is a really good example of a kind of contemporary one. The Marvel Cinematic Universe would be another one. So these are things which, you know, they might originate in one medium like comics, and then they end up in movies, and then they spread to games. And it's different to adaptation. Adaptation might be part of it. So it's not just retelling a story in a different medium, it's telling new stories in different media.
Yeah.
So in that regard, I would be very positive about it, because I would say actually that, like I said earlier, I think there are lots of opportunities kind of emerging if you are kind of fleet of foot and if you're not scared by this stuff. And that's the thing I would really encourage people to be not scared by it, because actually it's just a case of finding out and kind of learning about this. And actually that journey is just really, I think anyway, really kind of quite kind of exciting. To kind of find out about kind of new media and kind of think, well, you know, like I was saying earlier, I can't do this in this medium, but I can do it in this medium, and this is the strength. And it's always about them playing to whatever the strength, particular kind of strength of the medium is. So you've got transmedia storytelling, and you've got things like I think kind of Netflix kind of pushing into kind of interactive television with things like kind of Bandersnatch, if anybody kind of played that, which was that Charlie Brooker sort of interactive drama sort of thing, which was, you know, years ago when I first started teaching kind of interactive fiction, that would have been my dream to be able to show off stuff like that. And it's just, you know, but it is just a, you know, there are legacies, you know, this stuff has kind of been predicted, you know. Cinema and theatre and these different media have been experimenting with things like interactivity and stuff for kind of donkey's years. And it's, you know, it's just sort of a different way of doing it, really. So, I think that's the thing I would sort of recommend to kind of to new writers, really. It's just to kind of engage with the stuff if you're kind of interested in it.
Yeah. Stay fleet of foot.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, in terms of being fleet of foot, this is the ultimate challenge.
Well, he always picks it up, and it really isn't.
Well, it is time. This is without question. I mean, you know, we've had a fantastic conversation, but this is the highlight of the interview, which of course is Rebecca's random question.
Okay, my random questions always come to me randomly. I don't put too much thought into them at all. But we were watching tennis last night on Where was it?
Amazon. Yeah.
On Amazon, on the phone, and it was in California.
Yeah.
And they were talking about the fact it's hot all the time, or warm all the time, and comparing it to the British weather. And I thought, I wouldn't like to live where it's hot all the time. And then my question came to me. Okay, you're given a choice. You either live in the desert or you live on the North Pole, where it's one extreme or the other extreme. What would you choose and why?
I would definitely choose the North Pole, I think. I'm not somebody who does very well in kind of hot kind of environments. I did live in Australia for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So, but interestingly, so when we moved to kind of Sydney, we didn't stay in Sydney very long. We moved up to a place called the Blue Mountains, which was, has a kind of such a, kind of really, but a lot cooler kind of
yeah, it's much more benevolent climate there, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of, in fact, it rained for the first sort of month we were there, and it snowed when we were there and stuff. So it wasn't at all your kind of neighbor's kind of Crocodile Dundee kind of stereotype of what about, you know, life in Australia was going to be like. And then, you know, because there's a giant hole in the kind of the ozone layer. So it was kind of like constantly having to kind of put kind of like sunblock on and stuff, and sunblock on the kids and stuff. So, yeah. Fairly unambiguously, I would go for the cold environment. And I think, you know, you can make snowmen and stuff, right?
Yeah.
And you can play computer games to keep you warm.
Well, I know your answer, Rebecca, would always be snow related.
Yeah, I don't think I'd like to live in a really hot environment.
I don't deal with hot climates too well. And I have experienced sort of time in desert regions. Brief pockets of time.
Well, Devon was quite hot this summer when we were on holiday.
Football matches in Africa, but yeah, I think I'm leaning the way towards the North Pole as well. Actually,
there's also
there.
I mean, if nothing else, as you know, it's all getting warmer anyway, so you know, it's not going to be too bad.
You could get quite cozy in your igloo, can't you?
And also in Australia, I was going to say, there's the thing about kind of giant creatures like huntsman spiders that are kind of that big.
You don't get those in the North Pole, do you?
No.
That's a good point. I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time in Australia, a few months, but one of my jobs was cleaning toilets in a backpacker.
I thought you were going to say snake catcher.
No, but I have told the story on the program before. Another job I had for just a week, because I couldn't hack it, was working in a roadhouse in Northern Territory. Very, very old one. So proper, you know, tin roof, wooden shack kind of thing, been around for decades. And around the perimeter of this bar were the hats, the Akubra hats, you know, the ones, the felt hats that everyone knows about Australians, not with corks, but yeah, Bushman's hats. And all of, the, you know, so these were put up there when someone died. And then underneath it was an inscription which said who the guy was and how they died. And about 50% were snake bites.
Oh, wow.
another sort of 20%, there were usually holes in the hats, and that was gunshots. but the old lady who ran this place, she was an English woman who'd lived there for years. She was extraordinary. She was in her 80s. And if a snake appeared in the bar, quick as a flash, she came out with a shovel and would decapitate a King Brown. She was fearless. Totally fearless, but I was terrified by the place. I mean, you know, they came up through the floorboards and all sorts.
Right, so. North Pole it is.
Yeah, then. North Pole it is all around.
No, I was going to say I had to move. I'm quite an arachnophobe, and I had to kind of move a huntsman spider out of my daughter's locker at the, and it was literally that big.
Yeah,
and huntsmen are not poisonous, but they look like something out of Alien, you know, so they're all petrifying, and I had to use a flower pot to kind of move it, because it was, you know, we normally use a glass
here it's just a glass, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, your middle son is terrified if a daddy long legs gets in his room, then we've got trouble, haven't we?
Well, he'll send me a message on Messenger though, saying, can you come and get a spider out of my bathroom, please?
I know. Well, this is a bizarre thing, because our kids lived there with us, and like, but they're both terrified of tiny, tiny spiders. You know, I thought, surely we used to live with these giant things.
Yeah, and redbacks and funnel webs and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, pretty evil stuff. Right. Well, it's been a fascinating conversation. We thank you so much, and you know, it really has sort of, I think, encourage listeners to look in a different direction with their writing, of course, and to appreciate more what goes into making a broader form of entertainment. But in terms of finding you online and what you do, where should they look?
I'm pretty easy to find. I'm on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. And you can find the book. I'll just plug the book again, shouldn't I? The book is on Unbound, if anyone's interested in kind of supporting it. So, it would be really great. And you get your name in the back of the book. And it's a quite...
And the title is for when they're looking for the project?
It's called The Hero Never Dies. And I won't explain why, but, you know, if you read the blurb, you'll discover why that is.
Fantastic.
Brilliant.
It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. And we wish you all success with every project and every aspect of your writing career.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Colin Harvey. And I think, you know, Colin, like so many of our recent guests, all of our guests, let's be honest, I would love to hear more from. But, you know, there is a certain window of time that the podcast offers you. And I felt I could have talked again for several hours more.
Yes, we'd like to take him down the pub and have a pint, really.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't do that enough with our guests, but let's hope we can catch
up. It's difficult. But
with a few of them over the year to come. Wonderful. Thank you so much. And our guest next week?
Our guest next week is somebody called Sarah Dugdale. She's another one of the people who responded to my now very famous New Year's Day tweet asking for guests.
Astonishing, isn't it? How many we got? Yeah.
So we don't know a great deal about Sarah yet, but looking forward to finding out.
Yes, and you will find out all about Sarah next week as well.
Yeah.
So looking forward to speaking to Sarah Dugdale. That's terrific. So we're back to we really are looking at the grindstone this week in a major way, because you have significant deadlines to meet for the Writers and Artists Yearbook.
Yes, I mean, that's going to go on for another month or so. But we do have two exciting events that we're going to separately this week.
Mm.
So book I worked on and you've worked on as well.
Oh, yeah.
Right. As Arch Publishing Services, called called Transformational Selling. And that is actually having its official launch this week. Now, the two writers, Bryn and Steve.
Yep, have got Bryn Thompson and Steve Lowndes.
They've got two launches, one in Mayfair, which sounds very sort of lovely and posh. You're going to that one.
Yeah.
And I'm going to the rough it up one in Wilmslow.
Wilmslow's hardly rough. It's right in the epicenter of the Cheshire football belt.
Will I have to go on a sunbed or something, do you think?
Yeah,
get my nails done.
You need to be orange for that. I don't have to do that for the Mayfair one. So in fact,
I don't even know what Mayfair is. Somewhere on Monopoly board. I mean, what is Mayfair?
Mayfair is the most upmarket and most expensive part of London, bordered by Pall Mall and Oxford Street and Piccadilly and St James's Park. So, you know, I spent a bit of time there. In fact, one of my books that I'm writing is based in Mayfair. It's the home of various hotels that many people will have heard of, like the Dorchester, the Grosvenor House hotels are on Pall Mall.
I mean, that's amazing, isn't it?
It's just a pub up a room.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
okay.
I don't think it's, you know, it's not a three-star Michelin place. It's where, you know, even as recently, I was in Mayfair a few weeks ago when we were in London, and part of my overnight sleeping machine that I have for my sleep apnea broke. And there was a bloke in a basement selling the bits in Mayfair.
Or you can go and see him and say, I didn't sleep that well the first night I wore your new mask.
I mean, you know, it should have worked for me, but it blows a gale down me, so I get cold. So it didn't quite work out. But anyway, look, I'll go to the Mayfair one.
I'm going to the Wilmslow one.
And so that's really exciting. I've completely, honestly forgotten about that. That was this week. which puts more pressure on my studio time to finish my on the fourth of my five legionary books that I'm narrating at the moment. So back to battling Goths and Hun riders. So I look forward to that.
And I ought to mow the lawn on a sunny day if we have one.
Yeah, desperately needs it, doesn't it? The rest of our neighbours have ventured out, but then they've got petrol mowers and you've got an electric, which doesn't cut quite as well.
Yeah, somebody promised to.
I did. I know. It's one of those jobs that I said I'd do. But I went to the dump yesterday with the broken bookcase.
You did go to the dump with a broken bookcase.
You know, that's something.
That is something.
And, of course, I ought to sort of pay tribute to, I didn't get a chance to see her today, but it's her birthday very soon, so I'm going to go and see my mum before very long.
And it's Mother's Day today.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to say, and you were made a beautiful breakfast by your youngest son, Toby.
Yeah.
But then he left you to do the washing up.
Well, no, he did do some, and it wasn't him that left you to do the washing up so much.
But middle son, yes.
But then he did get cross with me, because he came out of his room and he said, I was going to do the washing up, and you've done it.
Yeah, right. So, yeah.
But yeah, so Toby, he's been planning my Mother's Day breakfast for about 2 weeks now, and he's done a little practice as well. And
it was very sweet. And I came down halfway through and put the extractor fan on because the place was filling with smoke. But I'm sure it looked tasty.
So what it was a bagel cut in half, toasted. On one half was a sort of onion scrambled egg ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
And the other half was an entire tin of chopped tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And then cheese and barbecue sauce on top. So it was delicious. It was just a lot of it.
Yeah.
But I ate as much as I could, and it tasted really good. He's very good at scrambled egg, that
boy.
He
is. He is. He is indeed.
And I had a phone call from our eldest child as well this morning.
Oh, which is nice. They covered all bases. But yeah, as I say, I'm going to see my mum in the near future. I doubt she was aware that it was Mothering Sunday anyway, but, you know, I am thinking of you, mum. But anyway, that's it for another week. So join us again on the Hobcast Book Show. We are at the moment in the process of planning some significant changes, not to the podcast content, but how we present it to the world. I'll say that.
That's all he'll say.
Yeah, it's we're gonna catch up with the rest of our rivals and do some different things, but we're also going to deepen the opportunities for information, make it easier for people to discover the podcast. So that's a bit of work that I'm working on at the moment on the side, alongside all the other things that we do here at Hoback Books. If you want to find out more about us as a company, then please look at our website, which is www.hoback.net, where for a short period at least, you can buy audiobooks direct. It's the cheapest way to do it outside of Audible.
So quick, get them now.
Get them now before Spotify bring down the shop front. Thank you very much. And for the rest of it, well, we've got tons of good news and blogs and details about our authors and our books.
And subscribe to us and you'll get our Sunday newsletter, which is an amazing piece of writing every week.
It is, because I'm doing it this week.
No,
I'm joking. I'm joking.
It's a highlight of my Sunday.
It is Rebecca's baby, and she does it brilliantly. So, thank you so much for joining us. I've been Adrian Hobart,
and I've been Rebecca Collins.
And it remains for us to wish you a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hoback Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hoback.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hoback online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.